Well, thank you very much for that very warm welcome and that generous introduction, which sure beats one that I had sometime last year. I was doing a convention in the north of England, and I was a little bit late getting there because I'd been held up on the motorway, but I was able to phone them and tell them I would be late, so they just carried on with the service. And I got in there 10 or 15 minutes after they had begun, and I just got that sense as I went in that the whole thing was rather turgid and flat and so forth. And everything the chairman said from then onwards rather confirmed my feelings. And I think we sang a hymn soon after I got in. And then the chairman said, and I'll give you the whole story. The chairman then said this: I only have one other duty in this meeting tonight, and that is to introduce our speaker. I've never heard him, but here he is. And sat down. Talk about a build-up. I mean, not even the name. But Graham, you've been much more generous than that, and I'm grateful. The subject that I've been asked to speak on tonight is dealing with Dawkins, and I feel a little bit like a case in America where a man was before a court on a very serious charge, and he was past middle aged, and well past middle aged, and the judge said, "Well, it's a very serious crime, and I'm going to sentence you to 99 years in prison," which is the kind of thing they do in America. And the man said, "But, Your Honor, I'm already 75 years old." And the judge said, "Well, why don't you go away and do as much as you can?" And I feel a little bit like that tonight on a subject like this. I can only do as much as I can, but I've promised the church faithfully that we'll be out by 12. Now, in case you've flown in from planet Zog, let me introduce the man who lies behind our subject tonight, who is Clinton Richard Dawkins, who was born in Nairobi, Kenya, in 1941. He is a biologist and a one-time Charles Simonyi Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He is now leading spokesman for what has become known as the New Atheism. He had what he says was a, quote, normal Anglican upbringing, but he began to doubt God's existence at the age of 9. However, he was reconverted, I'm using his word, he was reconverted to believing in God because of what he saw as the evidence from design. In other words, he couldn't believe that the wonderful things we see in the universe came about by accident and they must have had a creator. And so he was, as I say, reconverted to believing in God. He was confirmed into membership of the Anglican Church, and he, and I quote again, he carried a guttering torch for the Anglican Church, unquote. But then he was unreconverted when, and I'm quoting him again, literally, when I discovered Darwinism. At Oxford University, he wrote a thesis on selective picking in the domestic chick. But it certainly wasn't chicken feed because he was given a doctorate as a result. In 1976, he hit the headlines with a book called The Selfish Gene, in which he said, and I quote, "We, like all other animals, are machines created by our genes." However, it was 30 years later, in the year 2006, that his magnum opus hit the bookshops. And it is called, of course, The God Delusion, in which he not only drummed home his Darwinism, but he launched a nuclear attack on religion of every kind. In the preface to the book, he says, quote, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down," unquote. By page 36, he says this: "I'm attacking God, all gods, anything and everything supernatural." And then one page later, "Unless otherwise stated, I shall have Christianity mostly in mind." So his main thesis is God does not exist, and especially the God that Christians promote. And this meeting, of course, is this is a Christian church, and I've been invited as a Christian to give a Christian response to what Dawkins says and writes and apparently believes. Now, if the title "Dealing with Dawkins" sounds a bit harsh, it's certainly not meant to be so. I happen to know that a friend of mine spoke at a meeting called "Deconstructing Dawkins," and Richard Dawkins was there and said afterwards that he had no problem whatever with the title. So I know that Dawkins would be quite happy with our title tonight. I'm going to try to squeeze in 9 areas in which, frankly, and cards on the table here, I believe he's wrong. And I'll try to show you that in 9 different areas. Now, there may be someone here who objects and says, well, that's a little unfair because Dawkins isn't here, as far as I can tell, and therefore doesn't have an opportunity to respond. My answer to that will be to say several things. Firstly, I will base what I say on direct and accurate quotations from him. And I promise you, I will not get a single word out of place. I will quote him precisely. So although he won't get the last word, he will always get the first word. Secondly, I'll try at all times to play the ball and not the man. I have no interest whatever in attacking Richard Dawkins. I'm interested in his claims and not in his character. As far as I know, he may be a very caring and thoughtful man. He may be very compassionate. He may be very generous in his giving to those in need. He may be a model husband to his first wife and may have been a model husband to his previous wives. He may be an ideal person to have as a next-door neighbor. So I have not the remotest interest in attacking Richard Dawkins, in conducting what is technically called an ad hominem attack. And thirdly, there will be an opportunity for questions and answers and comments and interaction, and so everybody can join in, including anyone here who happens to agree with Dawkins. So I think that's clear the ground, and I'm being absolutely fair. Well, firstly, I believe he's wrong about science. Now, that may be a very brave thing to say, because on the one hand, we have Richard Dawkins with, I think, a number of doctorates in science and more awards and prizes on the subject of science than you could shake a stick at. On the other hand, I never studied science at school. In fact, there's one area of life in which I believe I'm on a par with William Temple, a one-time Archbishop of Canterbury, who said this: my ignorance of science is so profound as to be distinguished. And I'm with William Temple on that. I'm in exactly the same position. And you may say, well, therefore, this really, a referee should stop this fight. Well, first of all, it's not a fight, but this is a real, if ever there was a mismatch, it's this. Now, I'm a very keen amateur golfer. I'm not besotted by it. I haven't hit a ball since 3 o'clock this afternoon, but I am a keen golfer, and it's a bit like matching me against Rory McIlroy or Luke Donald or Tiger Woods or something like that, and he was 3 under today, if you want to know. Not that I'm interested in these things, but it just happened across my information system. So you think, well, that's a total mismatch. Well, just see if you think that in 5 minutes' time. Richard Dawkins, in a program called Soul of Britain, said this, I quote, "I think science really has fulfilled the need that religion did in the past of explaining things, explaining why we are here, what is the origin of life, where did the world come from, what life is all about. Science has the answers," unquote. Well, I think he's wrong. Frankly, he is plain wrong. Let me look at the 4 things that he mentions. First of all, why we are here. Science explains why we are here. It does no such thing. It's come up with theories about the mechanics, about how things happened, but it can say nothing about why things happened. It cannot say anything about the meaning of our existence. How is not the same as why. Secondly, science has the answers to what is the origin of life. Well, it simply doesn't. Charles Darwin fantasized about what he called some warm little pond that was full of chemicals, and tides and winds and atmospheric molecules somehow got swept together, and suddenly the first spark of life appeared. Well, it's pure speculation. He wasn't here to see it happening, and there's no way science can go back and invent something, and so that clearly is not the case. There's not a single shred of evidence to back it up. Thirdly, where did the world come from? Well, science does not tell us that. Modern cosmology is dominated by the Big Bang theory, but not even the Big Bang theory explains where energy came from. In a debate in Alabama in 2007, Dawkins admitted, and I quote, "Cosmology is still waiting for its Darwin," unquote. In other words, cosmology is still waiting for the person who will explain how the whole thing worked and so forth. The big question is this: why is there something instead of nothing? I mean, why is there a universe? Why are there sun, moon, and stars? Why is there our planet, and why are we here? Science cannot give us the answer to that question. And then he says, science explains what life is all about. It simply doesn't. In a 1995 issue of The Observer, Richard Dawkins was asked about the purpose of life. This was his reply, quote, "Well, there is no purpose, and to ask what it is a silly question. It has the same status as what is the color of jealousy," unquote. The most that Dawkins can offer is the idea that we are robots blindly programmed to preserve our genes. Now, is he right? Until the year 2004, the British philosopher Anthony Flew had a reputation as being the world's most notorious atheist. And then something remarkable happened to Anthony Flew. He changed his mind. And he wrote a book called There Is a God, telling us how his mind had been changed. And in the course of that book, he refers to Dawkins' idea that life is simply about passing on our genes. Now, this is what Anthony Flew, a leading philosopher, said, quote, "None of it is true or even faintly sensible," unquote. Now, nothing of what I've said so far is a criticism of science. Science is the ongoing process of discovering truth in the natural world. And I want to emphasize that. Science is the ongoing process of discovering truth in the natural world. But science cannot reach into the supernatural world. Its reach simply isn't long enough. I want you to imagine that you were crossing the Atlantic by a liner, and you couldn't sleep one night, so you got up onto the deck and wandering around with a torch in your hand, and you thought, it'd be interesting to see what the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean looks like. So you take your torch, you lean over the rail, you switch it on, and you can't see the bottom of the ocean because the reach of the torch isn't long enough. And in the same way, science's reach isn't long enough to discover what the supernatural is like. It simply does not work in that way. Richard Dawkins says, and I quote again, "Religion is no longer a serious candidate in the field of explanation. It is completely superseded by science." Now, my response to that is to say this, that scientific descriptions are not the only valid ones. Let me give you an obvious example. When my wife was alive, the last thing we did before I left on my travels was to juxtapose our orbicular muscles and have a reciprocal transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes. That's the scientific explanation of what we did. What we actually did was I kissed her. Now, the scientific explanation is a perfectly good one, a perfectly accurate one, but it's not the only one. And to say that the only definition that counts and is valid is a scientific definition, anybody who says that is talking through a hole in his scientific head. It simply is not true. Science can tell us many things, but it cannot tell us everything. As Professor John Lennox of Oxford University is fond of saying, science can tell you that if you put strychnine in your grandmother's tea, it will kill her. But science cannot tell you whether it's right or wrong to do so. Don't you think it's important to know that? Science can't even tell us why science works. There are many people who believe that Richard Dawkins shows that science proves there is no God. And I've met many people who would say that. Science proves, science can show us there is no God. Well, let me give you this quotation, this statement, by a very well-known scientist. Listen carefully. Science has no way to disprove the existence of a supreme being, unquote. That was said by a very well-known scientist. His name is Richard Dawkins, and he said it in a book called A Devil's Chaplain. The fact is that the God question has to be settled on other grounds. So he's wrong about science. Secondly, he's wrong about evolution, and as a biologist, this is obviously his big thing. He says it's the only intelligent explanation of life on our planet. Quote, "It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution," and he means macroevolution, the whole nine yards, "that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane," unquote. Elsewhere, quote, "The evidence is so strong that any sane, educated person has got to believe in evolution, unquote. In The Greatest Show on Earth, a book he published in 2009, he says this: those who believe in creation are deluded to the point of perversity, unquote. Now, this is a vast subject and one of only nine that we're considering tonight. I just want to flag up two cracks in it. Firstly, he pins his worldview, which is another way of explaining his faith, to the theory that evolution by natural selection gives us all the vast varieties of organisms and species we have on this planet. But wait a minute. However you fine-tune evolution, it has to begin with the first spark of life. So we're back to our Darwin's thought about there might have been some warm little pond somewhere. This first spark of life, which turns a non-living thing into a living thing. We've got to have a beginning. For evolution, you've got to have the thing that began to evolve in the first place. The first living cell, which has to be capable of reproducing itself. And evolution says that this warm little pond, and I'm not leaning too heavily on that, but anyway, some primordial soup is the place where the first self-replicating molecule came into being. In other words, it wasn't created, it just kind of happened. As someone puts it, the cosmic soup did not require a cosmic chef. Now, is it possible that that's how life came into existence? Well, there have been countless experiments using the most sophisticated equipment to try to produce life from inanimate chemicals. And at most, they have produced a few amino acids and not even one protein molecule on which life depends. So it's hardly surprising that the British astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle said, "The notion that the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial soup here on Earth is evidently nonsense of the highest order," unquote. Now, Dawkins shimmies around that roadblock in this way. He admits that the coming into being of the first self-replicating molecule is, and I quote, "exceedingly improbable," but then he covers himself by saying this: given enough time, anything is possible. So all we need is time, and the impossible becomes possible. Well, it's difficult to imagine a poorer argument than that. Of course, nobody believes that a fish suddenly became an amphibian, or that an amphibian suddenly became a reptile. Nobody would believe that. But, says Dawkins, given time, and that's the thesis of his book, Climbing Mount Improbable. You see, what he says is, nobody suggests that you can jump from the bottom of the mountain to the top just like that. But if there's a gentle slope, then moment by moment and centimeter by centimeter, gradually you could reach the top of the mountain. That's the way he shimmies around it. Well, let's ask this question. How much time would it take for evolution to get us where we are? One illustration I've come across is this. Amino acids are simple organic compounds, and there are about 20 of them. And they combine in vast numbers of ways to form proteins, which are the building blocks of life. And the average protein has 500 amino acids. Now, the question is this. Even if we assume that in this primordial soup there were 20 amino acids slopping around in Darwin's warm little pond, how long would it take to get them in the right order to produce one viable protein by chance? And one calculation is this. Assuming that the entire known universe was packed with computers, each the size of an electron, and each one of them tried a billion combinations every second, they would only get through a fraction of all the possible combinations in 300 billion years. And that is almost infinitely longer than the longest suggestion I've heard as to the age of the Earth. And yet, in spite of this, Richard Dawkins says, and I quote, "It has been the supreme achievement of human intellect to discover that there is no creator," unquote. He says also, and I'm quoting again, word for word, "Anglicanism has no creationist lunacy," unquote. Oh, really? Well, apparently he's not read the 39 articles of the Church of England, the first of which says, quote, "There is but one living and true God, the maker and preserver of all things, both visible and invisible," unquote. And Richard Dawkins says, well, thank goodness Anglicanism doesn't have creationist lunacy. It would be fair to summarize Richard Dawkins's beliefs in this area in this way. There is no God. Science has all the answers. And evolution is a fact. Well, case closed. Not quite. At the end of 2005, Richard Dawkins said this, quote, "I believe," now hear me carefully, listen to exactly what he said, "I believe that all life, all intelligence, all creativity, and all, quote, design, unquote, anywhere in the universe is the direct or indirect product of Darwinian natural selection," unquote. And you say, well, that's exactly what we would expect him to say. But this was in answer to a question. And the question was this: what do you believe is true even though you can't prove it? Unquote. Have you followed that? As a PS to this section, Charles Darwin was buried in Westminster Abbey. I'm sure that Richard Dawkins wouldn't want to be seen dead in the place. Thirdly, oh, I'm glad you got that bit. Thirdly, he is wrong about religion. Richard Dawkins doesn't like religion. He doesn't like religion of any kind. He says, quote, "To me, religion is very largely an enemy of the truth." In chapter 8 of The God Delusion, chapter 8 is called "What's Wrong with Religion?" And Dawkins isn't saying there's nothing wrong with religion, so why say there is? What he's really saying is there is something wrong with religion, and let me tell you what it is. And, incidentally, he begins the chapter by saying, quote, "I do not by nature thrive on confrontation." And I heard him begin a lecture in an American university by saying, let's begin with a bit of creation bashing. He doesn't believe in confrontation, you understand. His main argument against religion is that it's the root of so much evil. You remember not so long ago his three programs on BBC television called "The Root of All Evil?" And in the program, he invites us to imagine a world with no religion. And he says there'd be no suicide bombers, no 9/11, no 7/7, no persecution of Jews, no Northern Ireland troubles, no honor killings, no Taliban, and so forth. I want to respond to that in seven ways. Firstly, it is undoubtedly true that religious people sometimes do bad things, and sometimes very bad things. Secondly, it is equally true that many non-religious people do good things, and sometimes very good things. Thirdly, there is no way in which I can defend all religions or many things done in the name of religion. I'd go further and say that I confess to being ashamed of many things that have been done over the years in the name of Christianity, from crusades against the Muslims and others in the Middle Ages to modern atrocities such as that headed up by Jim Jones of the People's Temple, which resulted in 900 suicides. Fourthly, those who led those atrocities were disobeying the founder of Christianity, Jesus Christ. They weren't following him. Jesus taught, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you. Fifthly, Richard Dawkins says that in an atheist world, people wouldn't, for example, bulldoze cathedrals and tear down religious buildings. I hardly know whether to laugh or cry. Last week I was in Albania for the fifth time in 5 years. Albania was the first atheist state in the world. And when it became an atheist state, Christians were persecuted, left, right, and center. Churches were closed. They were shut down. Christian leaders were persecuted and put in prison. Bibles were burned. To object to the leadership of atheistic communism was to get in serious trouble. I know of one man who was tortured and put in prison because he wrapped his fish and chips in a newspaper which had a photograph of Enver Hoxha, the communist atheistic dictator, in the newspaper. And Dawkins says, if we lived in an atheist world, we wouldn't have that kind of thing going on. What kind of world is he living in? It simply is not the case. In the book, he makes virtually no mention of the most appalling expressions of violent evil in the history of the world. No religious tyranny in history has matched that spawned by atheism. Nazism's driving philosophy wasn't religion. It was pagan. It was atheism that fueled the Marxist-Leninist agenda, which resulted in the deaths of 60 million people. Atheism left 70 million dead in Mao Zedong's China. Atheism slaughtered 1.3 million people in Cambodia's killing fields. And here's the important thing. These people were following where their atheistic worldview led. Hitler was raised as a Catholic, but his policies weren't based on his Catholicism, but on his belief that Darwinian evolution taught that human beings were disposable. Lenin, the communist, said, quote, there can be nothing more abominable than religion, unquote. He believed that killing Christian believers was a social obligation, something consistent with his atheistic worldview. Sixthly, there are countless cases in which religion has been wrongly blamed. Religion had nothing to do with the appalling events in Tiananmen Square, when 2,600 peaceful demonstrators were killed. There was no religion involved in the genocides in Rwanda and Congo and Sierra Leone, or in the ruthless ethnic cleansing in Bosnia and Kosovo, or in the atrocities in Syria. The 3,000 people who were killed during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the Troubles were due to political differences, not to religious differences. If everybody in Northern Ireland, and I've been there 60 or 70 times, if everybody in Northern Ireland became a Roman Catholic or had become a Roman Catholic, those differences would still exist. The Troubles would still exist because they were political. And seventhly, in 400 pages in The God Delusion, he barely mentions a single benefit that has flowed from Christian faith. He mentions slavery, for example, and says not a word about Shaftesbury, who, because of his Christian conviction, spent his life leading the crusade to put an end to it. He says not a word about Elizabeth Fry and prison reform, or about the Christian Jean-Henri Dunant and the founding of the Red Cross. He says nothing about Thomas Barnardo and many others whose names are rightly revered, nor does he say anything about the millions of other believers who have sacrificed their possessions and sometimes their lives in the service of others, and who today fight AIDS, campaign against injustice and poverty and discrimination and third world debt. Richard Dawkins has not a single word to say about any of that, and his silence is significant. The broadcaster John Humphreys wrote to a friend of mine about his book. John Humphreys' book is In God We Doubt, and John Humphreys said this, quote, I refuse to accept that the world is a worse place for the existence of religion. The most appalling horrors of the past century were committed not in the name of God, but in the name of communism or fascism. The fact of the matter is that as a moral worldview, atheism is bankrupt. The Oxford professor Alistair McGrath says Dawkins is simply in denial about the darker side of atheism. And that may be one reason why a senior atheist scientist at Oxford University said of the programs The Root of All Evil that they were pseudo-intellectual drivel. Fourthly, he's wrong about morality. In the preface, he says, don't we need God in order to be good? Please read chapters 6 and 7 to find why this is not so. And chapter 6 is called The Roots of Morality. He argues elsewhere, and I quote, we are all, to a greater or lesser extent, moral, unquote. Well, now, if he means that as human beings we all have a moral sense, I entirely agree with him. No right-thinking person says there is no difference between right and wrong. Even the worst person has a moral sense. And I've already seen, and it's not a question of admitting it, it's an obvious thing to notice, people who utterly reject God can do good things and sometimes very good things. But to argue that this shows that God doesn't exist surely goes too far. I would agree with him on something else, that it's no good looking for the roots of morality in religion, because religions are man-made and flawed, and some have codes that are morally reprehensible, questionable at best. In fact, I would go further, and I would make a case, if pressed, to say that Christianity is not a religion. But that's another issue. You may want to raise that in the time of interaction. But he is wrong when he claims that man is gradually solving the moral problem. He mentions the Zeitgeist, one of those lovely German words, which really means the spirit of the times. And he says that the moral Zeitgeist is shifting. The progressive trend is unmistakable and will continue. Notice what he's claiming. He is saying, whatever the headlines say, whatever atrocities we read about, whatever the statistics tell us, whatever downward trends we think we see, man is gradually and inevitably getting better. The moral Zeitgeist is shifting and the progress is irreversible. A few years ago, I was preaching in California, and I took a few hours to visit the Queen Mary that was then moored in Long Beach, California. Fascinating tour of that ship. I was never able to travel on it commercially, but it was a fascinating place. And we got to the first class department, and there were these big mirrors, and I thought, there's something different about those mirrors. They're not plain. They have a sort of slightly pinky color to them. They were rose-tinted, if you like. And I asked someone why that was so, and they said, well, we didn't want anything to upset our first-class, high-paying passengers. And so when the thing was beginning to rock around a bit, and they thought, gosh, am I getting a bit pale? If they looked in the mirror, they looked in the pink, as healthy as could be. Well, I suggest to you that Richard Dawkins is wearing rose-tinted spectacles if he looks at today's world and said, hey, guys, things are getting better. Is racism disappearing? Is injustice being eliminated? Is materialism on the way out? Are people as a whole becoming more honest, more selfless, more generous, more humble, more self-effacing? But that's not really my main point. My main point is this. In the absence of God, how can we determine what is fair or unfair, right or wrong, just or unjust? Can we leave that to personal judgment? Now, if we do, we're in serious trouble. Hugh Hefner, the founder of the notorious Playboy empire, claims to have slept with over 1,000 women. But he told the Daily Telegraph, I'm a very ethical man. Moderation is the key. So he thought it was perfectly right. Can we trust ourselves to be certain and clear and undeniable in the matter of morality? Of course we can. Is that something the government can decide? If the government says a thing is right, it's right. And if it says it's wrong, it's wrong. What kind of world are you living in if you believe that? Shall we take a vote on it? And whatever the majority votes as being moral is moral. Do you really believe that would work? Well, of course you don't. If there are no moral absolutes, how can we actually pinpoint the difference between right and wrong? I was speaking in Oxford 5 years ago now, and an atheist in the audience, it may have been during the Q&A session, I think it was, said in quite a loud voice, clearly wanted to make herself heard, and she said this, all morality is relative. She said that the day after a South Korean student killed 30 people in Virginia Tech University. All morality is relative. So the correct answer to her, the correct response to her statement was to say this. Was the massacre of those 30 students relatively wrong or absolutely wrong? So the statement, morality is relative, is nonsensical. Without a transcendent benchmark, we can never be sure. And evolution certainly isn't the answer. Richard Dawkins says, and I quote, "I do have a strongly developed sense of good. But as a biologist, I haven't a very well worked out story of where that comes from," unquote. You bet he hasn't. But the most recent secular studies suggest that a sense of morality does seem to be hardwired into our psyches. But with God out of the frame, how can we make reliable moral judgments? Richard Dawkins says we should never believe anything for which we don't have factual evidence. This is one of his big things. If we don't have factual evidence, we should not be required to believe it. He was on a program called The Moral Maze. And Janet Daly asked him whether he believed that it was wrong to hurt people unnecessarily. And of course, he said, yes, of course it is wrong. Then Janet Daly asked him, what factual evidence do you have for that? And Dawkins blew a gasket. He simply did not have an answer to the question. With God out of the frame, the picture is horrifying. With God, with a non-existent God, the picture, morally wise, is horrifying. And yet Richard Dawkins says that we live in a universe of blind physical forces. Quote, listen to this. There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. This is Richard Dawkins. There is no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. But the fact of the matter is that in a world without God, what one animal does to another animal is morally indifferent, whether the animals concerned have two legs or four legs or none. Well, now, we've got through four out of the nine in relatively quick time. But I'm going to take a break, and maybe you think it's time to take one as well. So what we're going to do, I believe we're going to have it's euphemistically called a comfort break.
Have you ever debated with Dawkins yourself, was the question?
No, I haven't. I was invited to a centenary of an organisation in the north of England, and they asked whether I would have a debate with Richard Dawkins, and I said, well, you're welcome to ask him, but he will say no, because he is disinclined to debate with a creationist. Because he feels that being on the same platform as him would give the creationist kudos that he doesn't deserve. And there's evidence of that. Having said that, and to be fair to him, he has debated with John Lennox in Alabama and maybe elsewhere, and with Alistair McGrath on more than one occasion. So it's a little bit, there's a sort of grey area there. And who was in England recently from the States?
Bill Craig.
Yeah, William Lane Craig was in the States, and the organizers certainly wanted to have Dawkins up to debate with him, and Dawkins declined that, which I think was a great pity. He also declined to debate with Michael Behe, who wrote Darwin's Black Box, because Dawkins would say, well, my area of expertise is not the one in which Michael Behe is an expert. So there's a kind of gray area there, but I think essentially he's not too keen on debating in that way, and I'm not criticizing him for that, I'm just reporting the facts.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier, John, that you thought that Christianity is not a religion.
I thought you might pick that up. Let me say that I would define religion, religions, as man's efforts to reach out to the supernatural, to the transcendent, if you like. And there are hundreds of religions and thousands of expressions of that religions in the world. What makes Christianity distinct from all of those is that Christianity teaches God reaching down to man, and I would make that to be the difference. Oh, in general terms, Christianity is called a religion, and I'm not going to stamp my feet and say that's absolutely wrong, but there would be a case. I'd like to argue a case for saying that there are religions, man-made, and then there is Christianity. I may touch on that a little later, because we've still got 3 hours and 7 minutes. but that's essentially what I was saying.
Well,
yeah, that's interesting. You may be absolutely right. What I find very interesting is that people who agree with Dawkins's position, not only on evolution but on atheism, disagree profoundly with the way he is tackling things. Because, I better be careful here, but they don't like his approach to it. They think it's too argumentative and bitter and strident and angular and all the rest of it. I find that very interesting, but it may well be. Alistair McGrath writes somewhere about, he wonders whether these are almost the last gasp of the outright atheism that we've seen. But I've seen it grow in these, as our chairman has been pleased to say, these 50 years in full-time Christian service. I've seen the thing grow like that. I've never known a time certainly in all my years as a Christian, I've never known a time when Christianity is being sidelined, and not only sidelined, but pushed away and being told that it's just no longer relevant and let's move on. I've never known a time like that. But it may well be that kind of movement will overreach itself and that different times will come.
You said earlier that you discounted macroevolution. Do you accept microevolution?
Yes, because it's observable. And that's why we have long-legged dogs and short-legged dogs and long-haired horses and short-haired horses, because within a species or family, you can see there are changes. But I do not accept macroevolution, which says first there was nothing and then there was something and then it got life and then it became more complex and then it became fish and then they became amphibians and then they became reptiles and then they became birds and then they became four-legged furry creatures and then they became man. No, I don't accept that. There's no evidence for it.
So the question was, how does Dawkins explain away his apparent ignorance of Christianity?
Yeah. Oh, he doesn't, as far as I know. I mean, he doesn't. He simply attacks Christianity. And I'll come on to that more directly in a moment and show you why some of his attacks against Christianity and the Bible and so on are just... You don't have to be a rocket scientist to show that he's wrong. I'm not going to give you in my opinion he's wrong. Any person who uses 10% of their brain power will see that he's wrong. Well, thank you for that. So let's move on. And fifthly, if you remember, we got to four. Fifthly, he's wrong about God. Chapter 4 contains the central what he calls the central argument of the book. And in the tiniest of nutshells, this is what it says. There seems to be amazing design in the world. And therefore, the temptation to think that it must have been designed is there. But Darwinism shows this is an illusion. And in any case, he says, design would raise an even greater question. Who designed the designer? And the whole book leads up to this big point. Now, this is the killer question. Who designed the designer? A killer question. I would call it a kindergarten question, because it's one I've heard in junior school, senior school, and in hundreds of adult meetings, usually abbreviated to, who created God? Well, my answer to the question might include this. If you mean one of the gods of the ancient world, to give them their Greek names, Aphrodite, Apollo, Athena, Hermes, Zeus, and so forth, the answer is very straightforward. Men invented them. Or rather, men invented the idea that they existed, because they never existed. The Bible calls them idols, and the meaning of the word is they don't exist. So it's perfectly right to talk about the Aphrodite delusion or the Zeus delusion, because they never actually existed. But if you mean the God of the Bible, the answer becomes very different. Dawkins assumes that if there is a God, he must have been created. But he misses the whole point, that the God defined in the Bible is not created. He is, and I quote, the eternal God, and from everlasting to everlasting. So to ask a question like, who created God? If we're talking about the God of the Bible, the question should have one little word inserted: who created the uncreated God? And suddenly you see how silly the question is. It's like asking, why are some circles square? That's a daft question, because there are no square circles and no circular squares. And when Dawkins says he can disprove God because there can never be anything uncreated, well, it's just arguing circles. The truth is that everything that had a beginning had a cause. But God never had a beginning. In the beginning, God. And if someone says to me, well, I just can't grasp eternality, the idea of never beginningness and never endingness, my response to that is join the club. And how would I expect to be able to explain it? How would I expect a finite mind to explain the infinite? But the fact that I can't explain it doesn't mean it's not true, unless I assume the arrogant position of saying, unless I can explain it, it can't be true. Richard Dawkins says, and I'm quoting, God is a pernicious delusion. But as he doesn't even grasp the nature, the stated nature of God in Scripture, the God about which he said millions are deluded is just an invention of his own, and his argument is illogical and ridiculous. Sixthly, he's wrong about mankind. I know, I've never met him. I know very little about him as a person, and so there's no personal animus, and I made that clear at the beginning of our time together. I've got no criticism of his character, whatever. I'm trying to play the ball and not the man. But I do know this. I have a much higher view of him than he has of me. I do. His website calls me just another flea. But as I share that epithet with Alistair McGrath, an Oxford professor, I feel quite honoured. But that's what I'm dismissed as another flea. His main point is that human beings are, and I quote, just bytes and bytes of digital information. We are, and I quote again, throwaway survival machines, and that the only reason we exist is to pass on our genes. Whereas I think that human beings, including Richard Dawkins, are made in the image of God, and therefore capable of establishing and enjoying a living relationship with God in this life and in the life to come. And the greatest single statement in the Bible about that is in Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. So you see, I think that the most bitter and angry atheist in the world, and I'm not even suggesting that that's Richard Dawkins, I believe that the most godless, vicious, anti-Christian atheist in the world was created in the image of God. He bears in some measure God's image and is capable of having a living relationship with his maker. But Dawkins says we're just bytes and bytes of digital information. Quote, we are all descended from what might have been something like bacteria. Well, if so, where do we get our unique sense of dignity and our sense of morality, and our sense that life has meaning? Is there any hint of those in bacteria? Seventhly, he's wrong about the Bible. Well, needless to say, he doesn't think much of it. Oh, he does commend it, thinks people should read the Bible because of the language and the wonderful phraseology that it has and so forth. Well, talk about being damned with faint praise, but he thinks that bit about it. But this is what he says. The Bible is plain weird. It's a chaotically cobbled together anthology of disjointed documents. The only difference between the Da Vinci Code and the Gospels is that the Gospels are ancient fiction, while the Da Vinci Code is modern fiction. That's a great soundbite. I wish I could think of something as clever as that. But is it true? I want to make just three very quick points. Firstly, he says that the text of the Bible was passed on through generations by what we call Chinese whispers. You know, I tell you something, you tell him, he tells him, he tells them. By the time it reaches the 75th person, it's nothing like what I said in the first place. And there's little or no chance of the facts being passed on accurately. But in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they took our earliest written, and that's all we had in those days, manuscripts of the Bible. They took the earliest version back 1,000 years. So here are these handwritten versions passed on through many, many, many generations. And we said, now this is the earliest we've got. Then came the Dead Sea Scrolls, and suddenly, no, the earliest we've got is 1,000 years earlier. And the difference between those 1,000 years before these is so tiny as to be utterly insignificant. And they don't change one single doctrine in the whole of Scripture, nor do they have the slightest effect on its meaning. Secondly, he says that when the Gospels were written, nobody knew where Jesus had been born. But Matthew and Luke are quite clear that he was born in Bethlehem. Richard Dawkins says, well, they made that up. But he's got no evidence to support this. And listen to this one. He says that the Apostle Paul first came up with the idea of taking the gospel to the Gentiles. But in, I don't know whether to laugh or cry either. The last command that Jesus gave to his disciples, long before Paul became a Christian, was to take the gospel to every creature. It may be that Richard Dawkins' eyes are deceiving him. Maybe he should appear in that advert that says, you should have gone to Specsavers. And then he's wrong about Christianity. He says this, Christian theology is a non-subject. It is empty. It is vacuous. It is devoid of coherence or content, unquote. Well, I'm not surprised he says that. It may be because he has never read the Bible right through. It's certainly because he's never read it through with an open mind. One reviewer in reading Richard Dawkins on theology is like hearing someone lecturing on biology when his only knowledge of the subject is the Book of British Birds. I want to respond to just one point. Richard Dawkins says, quote, revealed faith gives people an unshakable confidence in their own righteousness. Well, that's his opinion. Christianity says exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. I mean, he couldn't be more wrong if he worked at it for 5 years. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Does Dawkins know no Greek? Doesn't he know that the word used for poor there is the lowest word you can use? The person who is utterly bankrupt, feeling utterly unable and unworthy to move an iota towards God, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who have the lowest opinion of themselves in terms of spiritual validity and so forth. Jesus said, he who humbles himself will be exalted. Listen to the Apostle Paul. He says that getting right with God depends, and I'm quoting, not having a righteousness of my own. Did you notice the distinction? Dawkins says, revealed faith gives people unshakable confidence in their own righteousness. But the leading New Testament writer says, I am right with God not because I've got my own righteousness. How wrong could Dawkins be? Not having a righteousness of my own, but having one that comes from God and depends on faith. The Bible says, by grace we are saved through faith. And that not of ourselves, it's the gift of God. It is not by works, so nobody can boast. Richard Dawkins couldn't be further from the truth. In 400 plus pages, I'm not sure that the word grace ever appears, and yet it lies at the heart of the Christian message. And ninthly, and how patient you've been, but you did have a comfort break. He is wrong about Jesus Christ. There was a book written many years ago called Christianity is Christ. It's a great title for a book. Because Jesus Christ is not only the founder of the Christian faith, he is its foundation. And Richard Dawkins is wrong in at least five major areas. Firstly, he says that Jesus, quote, probably existed, unquote. Well, there's nothing original and that idea. But in two words, he sweeps aside the written testimonies of at least 19 celebrated first and second century authors, including atheists, who record more than 100 facts about Jesus, even though they rejected his teaching. Nobody who doubts that Jesus ever existed deserves to be taken seriously. Oh, and Dawkins is not very hot on history anyway. In his book, he says that Thomas Jefferson, an American president who died in 1826, encouraged his nephew to read some apocryphal gospels, but they weren't in fact discovered until 1945, years after Jefferson had died. Secondly, he says there is no good, I quote, no good historical evidence that Jesus ever thought he was divine. Well, in the New Testament alone, the evidence is overwhelming. And I've got time to call just one group, and it's a very surprising group because it's people who didn't believe in him. In John 11, his enemies wanted to stone him to death. And Jesus said, "Why do you want to stone me to death? Is it because of the good things that I've done?" And they said, "No. It's because you, being a man, make yourself God," unquote. Did you remember what Dawkins said? No evidence that he ever claimed to be divine. These people heard him. They were there. And so they're surely likely to be better informed than Richard Dawkins. And then, incidentally, instead of correcting them, he laid claim to powers and privileges that belong to God alone. Thirdly, Dawkins says that Jesus taught that the Old Testament was wrong and it needed correcting. In fact, Jesus did exactly the opposite. He not only endorsed it, he said that he fulfilled it. He specifically said that he fulfilled the law and the prophets. Jesus said, "I have not come to abolish them." Dawkins says he thought they were wrong and needed correcting. It's difficult to see how Jesus' words could be twisted to mean that he thought they were wrong. Fourthly, Dawkins says that the idea of the atoning death of Jesus is, and I quote, "morally obnoxious," and I quote again, "repellent." And the Bible's teaching that Jesus died to bear the sins of others is, and I quote, "barking mad, as well as viciously unpleasant. If God wanted to forgive sins, why not just forgive them?" Is his thinking straight? A God who treats sin in that way, "Well, I'll just forgive sin. You do anything you like. You do it, I'll forgive it. That's my job. I forgive." I would not want to worship that kind of God. I would not love that kind of God because he would be immoral, giving people license to do whatever they wanted to do. And the idea that Jesus was a scapegoat, God executing an innocent and unwilling third party to pay for the sins of the guilty, that's schoolboy stuff. The Bible teaches no such thing. It says instead that in an amazing act of love, God bore the punishment that people like you and me deserve as sinners by coming into the world in the person of Jesus Christ and allowing himself to be put to death to redeem multitudes of sinful men and women on the basis that he himself had borne the penalty they deserved. And fifthly, and finally, Christianity is firmly pinned to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Without the resurrection of Jesus, his birth, his life, his examples, his miracles, his death would all lose their significance. The Christian faith has resurrection written all over it. I was speaking in the University of Cape Town a few years ago, and an atheist was actually quite noisy during the presentation, which was interesting. Had a long conversation with him afterwards, a very long conversation, discussion, and eventually one of the people involved in my tour said, "John, you've got another appointment. You just must come now." And I said to this young man, "Well, look, you've asked me a lot of questions. Let me just ask you one question. What do you think of Jesus Christ?" Now, this was his reply. Now, remember, this is an atheist. And he said, "Well, I'm not sure, but I do know this. Everything depends on whether or not he rose again from the dead." That was an atheist. And he was, of course, speaking the truth. Now, that is clearly the central thing about Christianity. Not about the teaching of Jesus or the miracles of Jesus or the example of Jesus or the leadership of Jesus. It's about the death and resurrection of Jesus. Well, what does Richard Dawkins do with it? He's concerned to destroy Christianity, wipe it away, have nothing to do with it. What does he do with the central point about Christianity? He totally ignores it. In the Alabama debate, he tells us why. He dismissed the resurrection, and I quote, as petty, trivial, and local. And so I would make two comments to close. If the God delusion is mainly an attack on Christianity in the hope that Christians will turn away from it and those who aren't Christians won't be attracted to it, why not show that the foundation of their faith is a myth? All you have to do is to destroy the resurrection of Jesus and the whole of Christianity collapses in a heap. I suggest that his science says a lot. Andrew Wilson, in a delightful little book, says that to ignore the resurrection and then claim to have dismantled the Christian faith is like chasing mice out of the sitting room and announcing that the house is free from animals when there's an elephant sitting on the sofa. And secondly, the resurrection of Jesus means that Jesus is not just an astonishing, remarkable personality whose life is given to us in the pages of an ancient book. It means that he is alive today, that he is the living God. That means that all his statements are true. It means that all his promises are dependable. It means that all his warnings are real. And it means that he has a prior claim on your life and mine. If Jesus rose from the dead, we are responsible to respond to him as our creator and as the one who died in the place of sinners. And I would call you as we close tonight to turn to him if you've never done so, and to trust in him and to prove that what he says is true. And millions of people over thousands of years have done that, and I know many in this room have. And of those millions of people over thousands of years, not one has ever proved his promises false. Not one. And that is another issue that Richard Dawkins simply does not address. But I urge you to address it, because there's not a more important question that you will ever face in this life. Well, now, I think two things as we close. What about refreshments? Are there any? No.
There'll be some more on the way out.
Okay, like. There are some refreshments on the way out. That's the simple bit. I do want to thank you for coming. There's so many other things you could have been doing tonight. You could have been watching Coronation Street. But thank you for coming. I'm just so encouraged by the number of people and the excellent way in which the church has arranged it. And I love this cafe-style approach. I think that's really excellent. And secondly, I want to thank my colleague Howard Williams there at the back, who, in association with my main publishers, Evangelical Press, one of whose board members is sneakily running the eye over me tonight to make sure I've got things right. I want to thank him for the hard work he puts into these tours. He does all the hard work. He does all the driving and the lugging around of stuff, and I just stand up and tell the truth every night. So I've got the easy part, and he's got the difficult part. You will have had a leaflet when you came in, and take that away with you, because at the back there is an order form. So all the materials that are listed on the back, you may order from the publishers, and at the same discounted prices that they have here, and there's no charge for postage either, which is rather remarkable. But I do just want to mention just a few titles as we close. Firstly, if you are saying, goodness gracious, I can't take in a 50th of what was said tonight, well, the answer is a book called Dealing with Dawkins, and I won't repeat this. Everything there is discounted, and some of it quite heavily, but Dealing with Dawkins, and there are copies of that. With Easter approaching, I think I've got about 10 of my booklets there. These two might be of a special interest. Why the Cross? I had the privilege of being at the launch of this in Albania a week ago, and today on my desk arrived the version in French, which was rather lovely, but Why the Cross and Jesus Dead or Alive. So the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus in those two booklets. Now, our chairman has already said that I have been in the ministry for 50 years, and Les White, who's here, board member of EP, was among those who craftily arranged the dinner in my honor in London about 2 weeks ago. I knew nothing about it except the date, and you better turn up, which I did. And then they, there was one rather nice thing they did for me. They produced what's called a Fetschrift, which is a, it can be in academia, a series of learned papers in honor of some worthy. Well, I wouldn't attract that, but it was a rather, it looked like a photo album, lovely thick cover, and goodness, statements from England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, Albania, South Africa, the United States, and some lovely pictures too, and the whole thing most beautifully presented, and I was thrilled to bits about that, speechless about that. And then from under the table, they produced something else, a biography that had been written about me in the last year. I knew not a solitary thing about it. So you can imagine my heart nearly stopped. I mean, it was shocking. That's the word to use. It was shocking. And the book is called Hear Me Carefully. And I'll use that phrase tonight because this crafty person who wrote it, she happens to be Howard Williams' wife. She obviously knew I used that phrase, so it's called Hear Me Carefully, biography of John Blanchard. And there, it tells the story of my being born in Guernsey in 1900, none of your business, and my evacuation to the Hebrides during the war, where I spoke Gaelic instead of English, my return there, my life as a fully paid-up religious hypocrite for some years. Then when I met a lovely girl who dragooned me into hearing somebody preach the gospel, and I became a Christian and did the only decent thing and married the girl. And then my call into full-time service all those years ago, and the way in which God has led me into work both here in the United States, behind the Iron Curtain, and all around the world. And the whole story is there, including, I think, about 20 photographs from 7 different countries, and it's called Hear Me Carefully. But at about the same time, almost the same day, let me do a little bit of market research, and then we're through. How many people here have in the last year spent a great deal of time studying and seeking to master the teaching of the last 12 books in the Old Testament, the ones that we call the Minor Prophets? Just stick your hand up, and I won't accuse you of bragging. Oh, you're bragging. Oh, yeah, and the two of you have. Well, that's a pretty small percentage. Well, now, then we're on a winner here. It just so happens that I spent virtually the whole of last year studying those 12 books, and I've just produced this, I mean, brilliantly presented, I will have to say that, by Evangelical Press, called Major Points from the Minor Prophets. So what Howard Williams has done tonight and on this tour is that, and in round figures, I hate these 99 pence things, the major points from the Minor Prophets cost £10, and the biography costs £7. That makes a total of 17. If you get both, you get them for £10. Now, as this is £9.99, the biography is a penny. So that's what they think of me. So the teaching may be okay, but I'm worth a penny. And literally, as long as supplies last, as all people rightly say, you can have both for £10. But there are other titles there, and you may have an interest in those too. But thank you again for coming. Do take away what you were given as you came in, and I'll hand back to the chairman. And I love this phrase that Americans use, and then we will be dismissed.